sexual identity with the Palestinian liberation struggle. Co-curated with programmers from Regard Palestinia and co-presented with the Feminist Media Studio and the Palestinian Youth Movement, the event is part of Queer Cinema for Palestine, the first ever 10-day film festival celebrating global queer realities and standing in solidarity with Palestinians. The screening at La Sala Rossa will be followed by a discussion led by the Palestinian Youth Movement. All films will be available to stream online between November 15 and November 20th through queercinemaforpalestine.org. We hope to see you there.
If you have flu-like or COVID-19-like symptoms, such as fever, cough, loss of taste or smell, or if you have been in contact with someone infected with the virus, it's essential to get tested and to follow isolation instructions, even if you're vaccinated. Screening remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. To find out more, visit
CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Attention McGill undergraduate students, referendum is upon us. Exercise your right to vote on questions that matter to you and your campus experience. Vote in the fall referendum period from Monday, November 8th to Friday, November 12th. Look for your ballot in your McGill student email between November 8th to 12th. Let's rock the vote.
If you're young at heart, for it's hard you will find to be narrow of mind. If you're young at heart, you can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh till your dreams fall apart at the seams, and life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth when you're young at heart? For it's hard you will find to be narrow of mind when you're young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you derive out of being alive. And here's the best part, you'll have a head start if you are among the very young at heart.
Good evening and welcome to Older Women Live on CKUT at 90.3 FM. We're a small collective of feminists and we're on the air once a month, the second Wednesday from 6 until 7. Our show this month, November 2021, coincides with a couple of events in the world. One is the Climate Crisis Conference, COP26, taking place in Glasgow, Scotland. It's also close to Remembrance Day, which is the 11th, Poppy Day, when Canadians remember those soldiers killed in wars. Most people, both Canadian and others, think of Canada as a benign country, a peace-loving people, but nothing could be further from the truth. Canada is amongst the leaders in exporting military hardware. We're also number one in the world for mining extraction. Metals and minerals, of course, are used in weapons. Today we're going to be looking at a recently published book which looks at the past and present human rights violations in Guatemala and how they're intertwined. and linked to issues of capitalism, which in turn, in many cases, link to climate degradation. The book is Testimonios, written by two Canadian professors from the University of Northern BC, Catherine Nolan and Graham Russell, and published by Between the Lines on the 25th of October. It exposes the state machinery of exploitation of the Guatemalan communities for the benefit of Canadian mining companies and Canadians in general, and Canadian shareholders.
Older Women Live, CKUT 90.3 FM, would like to thank Catherine Nolan, Rice Action, Doña Angelica Choc, and Carla Patricia for making these interviews possible. We welcome Catherine Nolan to our program. She is a professor at the University of British Columbia, a writer, and a human rights advocate.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be here. I'm coming to you from the unceded and traditional territory of the Tsleil-Waututh in Northern British Columbia, where I work at the University of Northern British Columbia. And I begin our conversation here sending my respect to the Mayan Xinka people and their territories that we'll be talking about today.
Thank you very much. So please briefly tell us about yourself, your book Testimonio, and your work.
Thank you. Well, as you say, my name is Catherine Nolan. I'm a professor of geography at the University of Northern BC, and I've also been a longtime social justice and human rights advocate in the context of Guatemala, in the context of what we know to have been genocide, a series of genocides, really, in the country of Guatemala against the indigenous Maya people. And I first traveled to Guatemala in 1992 as a university student, and my life was really turned upside down. And I think it was the call of many people to amplify their voices, to tell others about what was going on, what had gone on, and what continues to go on in the country. And so I've been connected to Guatemala and the issues of human rights and social justice since that time. And I've been very fortunate since 2004 to work with Graham Russell of Rights Action, an organization based in Toronto and the United States, and works extensively in Guatemala and Honduras, dealing with many issues of post-genocide life and the ways in which people are trying to move forward in a positive way, but continue to be confronted with a lack of justice and accountability for past crimes connected with the genocide and other violations. And it was in 2004 when we first started hearing about Canadian mining companies and the operation of an historical mine, the Phoenix mine, near El Estor in the northwest sort of part of the country towards the Caribbean coast. Many of us in Canada will know INCO, the big Canadian international nickel company, but many wouldn't know that it had operated in Guatemala and had had a concession to over 250 square kilometers around El Estor on the Kekchi, Maya Kekchi people's territory since the 60s, and had started processing nickel for a very short amount of time, right when the internal armed conflict was really strong in that region in the late 70s, and so shut down after only about 1 year of operation. But in 2004, that 40-year concession was coming up. Would they continue it? Would they sell it? Would it go back to the state? And communities from El Estor and all along the Pulacheek Valley were really concerned about the fact that it might start up again. And sure enough, it was sold to Sky Resources based in Vancouver. And so we have followed and worked with the people of that region since that time, as they were concerned about the restart of the mine and the activity leading up to it, the exploration, which would mean that people would be displaced from their home territories. And so the book that we have coming out now called Testimonio, Canadian Mining in the Aftermath of Genocides in Guatemala, which just came out October 25th, documents that struggle connected to the Phoenix mine that has been owned now by a series of Canadian mining companies and now sold off to a Swiss-Russian company. That mine, as well as the Vancouver-based Goldcorp, their Marlin mine in the north and west of the country, the Escobal mine, which is towards Honduras and El Salvador, that used to be owned by Tahoe Resources, based in Vancouver, and now by Pan American Silver. Just outside of Guatemala City, just north, a struggle called La Puya, which is connected to a mine operation that was owned by Radius Gold and now owned by an American company, KCA Associates. And so we document those four main mining struggles. So there are others, of course, but those are the four main ones that are connected to Canadian mining operations, who are kind of the majority of mining operations in the country. And we've worked to gather the voices of people that we worked with for these last 16 or 17 years. So community members gathering their testimonials, the collective sharing of these violent experiences of dealing with Canadian mining operations that are called development. They're called development in the Canadian context. These companies are bringing development to this region. And what they're facing with instead is, of course, violence, violent evictions, health and environmental harms, all sorts of violence, murder, rapes, homes burning down, and the criminalization of people who are in resistance to this imposed development model. So we've included, of course, their voices along with people who work with non-governmental organizations, activists, journalists, filmmakers, documentary photographers, and lawyers, to get a really good sense of what is happening and what their call is when they say, no more mining, no to mining, yes to life. What does that look like from a bunch of perspectives? And then offering some ways in which this can be changed, harnessing all of our energies, working together to try and end this violence.
Catherine, you and Graham Russell have done an enormous work to get testimonial published, collecting all these testimonies of people, victims of Canadian mining companies, journalists, and advocates of human rights. Your book leads me to think about the continuity of Guatemala's powerful and corrupt economic, political, and military elites with the support of the United States, Canada, and others from the 1950s to the present. How do these elites operate to ensure continuity with such impunity?
And we haven't included the voices of the elites and those who are signing these agreements and making this possible because, well, for many reasons. One, that I don't think they would tell us anything different than what they would put on their companies' websites or on the government's websites and so on. But I think when we pull back the picture of what's actually happening, look at the actual documentary record of what is happening here, when we reel ourselves back to the end of the interim conflict, so ending with the peace accords in 1996, and many of us were focused on the hopeful moment that brought, that civil society and so many voices of people, survivors, to work for positive change. But at the same time, laws were being changed to open up the country for foreign investment as a way to supposedly move the country forward out of this conflict. But of course, what it was doing was not doing that. It was going to be lining the pockets of people who were already in control and who were responsible in many ways for what had happened. And so the mining law changed. And so I, as you rightly mentioned, the United States is so deeply implicated in what happened during the internal armed conflict. But the argument of our book really is that Canadian mining companies, with the support of the Canadian government, use that moment to cash in on the social, you know, disintegration of communities at that time, how there was very little resistance at that moment, right? This has changed over time, of course, but that moment of the mid-1990s was a time of just recovering from the massacres, the disappearances, the detentions, all of this that people who survived lived through. Companies came in signing agreements for concessions to large amounts of land. And so they are dealing with, you know, people at the national level, people at the community level where these mines were operating had no knowledge that this was happening. These aren't agreements. There were no consultations, as of course, is international law, right? No consultations. People didn't know that anything was happening until shovels were in the ground and bulldozers were arriving. And so I think what we can see is that the political and economic elite of Guatemala, along with the Canadian companies and Canadian government, have worked to use the law to make these mining operations happen, in addition to many others, whether it's, you know, agriculture for export or hydroelectric projects and so on, that the country is... many people call it a failed state, but I don't call it a failed state. It's operating the way in which the political and economic elite want it to operate, which is to access, to exploit and plunder the natural resources for the benefit of a very few. And so when we see the mining law that was put in place and the way in which it's changed over these last decade and a half or so, that it went from, you know, royalties that would come back to the country would be 6%, let's say, which is low, but in the realm of what happens in other countries, it was brought down to 1%. It was an attempt to just open the door and mainly Canadian mining companies and their investors to come in and plunder. Really, 1% being left to the country is the plunder and exploitation of the natural resources.
Even the problem is that even that little 1% doesn't really reach the community, and the companies don't even try to repair the damage caused to the area. So
that's right. And we see that with the Marlin mine. It's one of the mines that we have documented kind of from opening till closing, opening or starting to operate in the 2004 and has already now closed, where there's a you know, no closure plan that has been shared with the communities, but ceased operations, at least for now. And we see that, of course, with these agreements to have the concession and operations, licensing and so on. Well, first of all, that many of them never got proper licenses. That's something that's coming out, of course, as we dig in, and many people dig into how these companies got the ability to operate in the first place, and many had no legal operating license. What comes to the communities? Well, that 1%, half stays with the national level government, half a percent is supposed to come to the municipality in which this is happening. And yet, of course, more damage is done than one half a percent of a royalty payment can deal with. And people are left, of course, then with the lack of water, the depletion of water resources, the health harms, the damage, of course, inability to grow crops and so on, and intensification of impoverishment over time. Not so, you know, at the end of the day, there were some jobs that were brought to some of these communities, but that does not outweigh what has been lost.
So the elites maintain continuity with impunity by taking advantage of the moments in which people are recovering from the abuses of human rights. The elites modify the laws to benefit their own interests and to attract international investments. Besides, I think that the continuity of the parallel violence that illegal structures carry out against people defending their rights is a key element to sustain this modus of operandi. This violence has been applied against not only defenders of their territory, but also against some of us that were asking for a just, fair, and inclusive world, a better world during the internal armed conflict. How could these elites achieve this even after peace accords were signed between revolutionary organizations and the government of Guatemala?
when we look at who is signing, who is in place to open the doors to the Canadian mining companies, who is signing the agreements to hand over, you know, the concessions for the companies. I mean, they're the very people who are responsible in many ways for what happened during the internal armed conflict. So if we think of Otto Perez Molina, the previous presidents who's, you know, in jail on corruption charges and so on. I mean, he was a general in the Ischil region, which is the site of one of the documented sites of genocide. He then is opening the door for these companies. Canadian government sees the current government, which is anything but democratic, as their democratic ally. Same with Honduras, right? The Canadian government has not once called out the violence that we have brought to their attention, and many people have brought to their attention connected with mining operations. They either pretend it's not happening or that they know about it, but there's nothing they can do about it. They say that companies, they hold them to, you know, corporate social responsibility documents that they produce themselves, that is all voluntary and of course not mandatory, and make it very difficult for people to hold Canadian companies and their, you know, on the ground subsidiaries for crimes and violations once they're identified. So the Canadian government is supporting what's happening on the ground in Guatemala in many ways. And we see that, yes, it's many times the same people who are making this possible. What more can we say on this matter? It's extremely challenging. That's why we really have brought together the context of the genocides and what's happening on the ground now connected to Canadian mining operations, that, as you say, the continuity of violence is so obvious. The tactics that are used, I mean, post peace accords, the military was not to have any role internally within the country. And what we find now through documents that have had to be turned over in some of these lawsuits that fortunately are now moving through the Ontario courts, the company's own records show that they have alliances with directly to the president of the country, directly to the governors of the regions in which they're operating. And when they need people to be moved off the land, you know, calling them, you know, indigenous people whose territory they're operating on, they call them, you know, invaders or squatters on the land, and can call up the military and anti-riot, you know, police squads to come in and violently remove them from the land. And so we see this very moment connected with the Phoenix mine in El Astor, where finally the ancestral authorities in that site, now after 40 years of dealing with this, have managed to push, along with many others, to get an actual consultation to follow the law. And so the Constitutional Court ordered that operation to cease 2 years ago, in 2019, and it has operated almost 24 hours a day, 7 days a week anyways. And finally, the ancestral authorities at early October started to block the road to mining equipment. And so a small but symbolic, I think, protest that to try and amplify their voices of concern about what was happening. And what did we see? But, you know, last week, you know, more than 1,000 military and police that were brought to El Astor to violently remove people who were peacefully protesting on the roadside, and a state of siege imposed for the whole department or, you know, province where the mining operation is happening. And so the state well uses similar tactics from the past to frighten people. We can hear, as the reporters are talking to people on the ground, helicopters are flying over, heavily armed state forces are there to raid people's homes, to frighten people, to detain people who are in resistance to this, and seeking out those, as you say, people who are calling for a better world. These are the people whose homes are being raided. These are people who've peacefully protested, and they are the ones who are being targeted and criminalized.
Thank you, Catherine. You mentioned Otto Perez Molina, who was judged for cases of corruption. Otto Perez Molina, during the internal armed conflict, operated under the facto government of Rios Montt. Rios Montt was sentence because of genocide. He was guilty of crimes against humanity and genocide. So that means that the struggles of our communities in Guatemala go a long time. So it's been a long time since they have been struggling, defending the rights. I really admire the resistance of our ancestors, Mayas, and the indigenous people of the Americas. They have suffered so much since colonial times, since the Spanish came to America looking for minerals, dispossessing the true owners of the land.
Well, yes, I think you're right. It's 500 years and more of struggle in this cycle of colonialism, genocide, and now what many people are calling like a fourth invasion. So mm-hmm. George Lovell at Queen's University, Professor Lovell, has written about the three cycles of conquest connected to that Maya people have experienced: the colonial Spanish invasion, then what he calls the invasion of international capital, when land was transformed to property, right, to be mm-hmm. handed over for the production of coffee and bananas and cotton and so on. The total transformation of the meaning of land to become property to be used and exploited. And then kind of the conquest or, you know, invasion of state forces against the Maya people into their communities during the genocides. And so many of us, including Maya scholar Giovanni Batz, who has a new book coming out on this very issue called The Fourth Invasion, which is really the invasion of international capital, mainly Canadian mining capital, to again cash in on the possibility to exploit the natural resources for money to be brought back to Canada and elsewhere, and plundering it from the Maya people themselves. So it gets us thinking about, you know, what is land and what does it mean to different people? You know, for many people we talk to in communities who have been in resistance all along, you know, land is for sustenance. Land is for family. Land is for continuity with ancestors. Land is their mother, right? Many people talk about their land as the honey of their lives that sustains them. And yet they're facing another vision of land as property for exploitation and profit making. And these are very distinct ways of understanding our place in the world and how we want to live. And I'm so, as you say, I'm so inspired by the people on the ground and their supporters who are fighting for the only way possible for a future for ourselves, which is for land is for life.
Thank you, Catherine. I agree with you. Your statement that it is a matter of what we think land is for. I am all the way for land is for life. I would like to add one more point, and it is about the fact that Canada has investments in extractive industries in 120 countries around the world. But what I couldn't believe when I first came to Canada was that Canadian elites also mistreat, dispossessed, and exploit their own indigenous communities.
That's exactly right. And I think the more that we do this work, the more parallels we see that this is a struggle for all of the Americas, mm-hmm. and that Canadian mining companies are Canada is the home base for 3/4 of the mining companies that operate through the Americas. Yeah. And so they're major players, and the same companies operate in Canada. And many people are making those connections that we have to start seeing these as patterns, that this is logical and predictable what is happening mm-hmm. when laws and regulations are set up the way they are, which are very much in favor of mining companies and their investors versus the communities on the ground.
Thank you very much for your sharing all your knowledge. You have immense knowledge about all of this. And we thank you for your solidarity.
To truth, memory, and justice, maybe be able to change these conditions.
To true memory and justice, and for people united around the world, struggling against these powerful elites that oppress us. If people are interested in buying Catherine's book, testimonio, go to riseaction.org or the publishing company Between the Lines. Thank you very much.
Renaceremos desde las cenizas, somos el fuego que quema la historia. Crecemos alto como la milpa y nuestros hilos tejen la memoria. Renaceremos desde las cenizas, somos el fuego que quema la historia. Crecemos alto como la milpa y nuestros hilos tejen la memoria.
Nos han querido exterminar, nos quitaron la tierra. Nos han querido dominar, nos hicieron la guerra. Para obligarnos a callar, cortaron nuestra lengua. Pero crecemos como flores en la primavera. Nos tomamos las calles porque son nuestras. Ni de Piñera, ni Maduro, ni de Ortega. Sus falsas democracias van para la hoguera. Porque el pueblo no perdona a nuestros muertos, nuestras muertas. Ni sus militares, ni sus policías podrán cuidarlos de esta furia colectiva. Ni sus militares, ni sus policías podrán cuidarlos de esta furia colectiva.
Renaceremos desde las cenizas, somos el fuego que quema la historia. Crecemos alto como la milpa y nuestros hilos tejen la memoria. Renaceremos desde las cenizas, somos el fuego que quema la historia. Crecemos alto como la milpa y nuestros hilos tejen la memoria.
San Pericati, Trika Mama, Arika Tina, Mitrika, Trikatata, Halajo Mine, Halajo Kamolta, Eishka, Jotash Kichupikana, Oblika, Chatelika, Kasling, Ponim Bajoni, Galar Sahapo, Panutish, Ponim Bajoni, Galar Sahapo, Panutish, Rika Kohle, Rika Tzirika, Chael, Rike Moriru, Tikon Rika, Chumir, Paulet, Romari Mahush, Chichupta, Kavech, Telko Kuhe, Chukuhol, Ririt, Ech, Riulet, Romari Mahush, Chichupta, Kavech, Yossi Haniki, Nirukushi, Chule yo y shani tosi kiri inha kushi kucha rojo coba ve rojo coba ve mata me estás mi casi kiri rojo coba ve mata cayonita os pertenez ni un recachel ni casi kiri coba ve.
Guatemala's powerful and corrupt economic, political, and military elites that operate with corruption and impunity and the support of the United States, Canada, and others from the 1950s to the present affect thousands of victims. These victims suffer from the violence that illegal structures in Guatemala apply on behalf of these elites against people defending their rights. These communities just want to live on their lands with their families in peace. One of these victims is Doña Angelica Chop. During our interview with Catherine Nolling, she talked to us about the current state of siege, raids, and violence in El Estor Izabal, Guatemala, where Solway, a Swiss mining company with participation of Russia and Canada, operates, and Angelica lives. She met with other women from Lote Ocho. They are 8 out of the 13 plaintiffs in the Canadian lawsuits against Hudbay Minerals. They were victims of sexual abuse and violence by the Army, National Police, and Hudbay security personnel in 2007. Angelica's husband was killed by Hudbay security personnel in 2009. Let's listen to her message.
Ante los medios nacionales e internacionales, nosotros las mujeres quechís del pueblo del Estor Izabal, afectado por la minera empresa, antes era canadiense, hoy rusa, queremos manifestar nuestro gran repudio en contra de todos los atropellos que está pasando actualmente. es demasiado los golpes que hemos recibido, ya hemos sufrido mucho. Pedimos a los medios nacionales e internacionales que intervengan y que tomen en cuenta todo lo que está.
While Angelica was delivering her message from Guatemala, we could hear the sound of the helicopters flying over their community to intimidate them. Here is her message translated into English. To national and international media, we, the Maya Quechí women of El Estor Izabal, affected by Solway mining operations. Before it was Canadian and now it is Russian. We denounce all the abuses that are happening right now in our community. It is too much, the attacks we have received. We have suffered much. We ask that the national and international media, that you intervene and consider all that which is happening. Very often, much of the information reported is told by corrupted medias paid off by the mining company. They say that we are the problematic ones when this is not the case. We are here in our homes. We, as women, are afraid because they are coming into our neighborhoods, helicopters of the colonial state. They pushed forward all the way to here, to our resistance, thousands of riot police and military special forces. And today, the women of Lote Ocho, we have come together to ask our ancestors that this may all end, and that we are left to live in peace on our lands, our territories. We demand of the government of Guatemala that they leave us to live in peace. We indigenous women are living in fear. The children are afraid because we are living under state terror. There are so many helicopters flying above us, and there are so many police, while our people are defenseless in the streets. I am Angelica Choc. I am worried about what is happening. I ask to the national and international authorities and to the president of Switzerland, the home country of the Solway Minerals, to regulate and hold accountable your citizens who come here. The companies that come here in our territory, please leave us in peace. Dialogue, as our women and men have said, has been exhausted. You have excluded the indigenous people of this land. Our ancestors have been excluded by the authorities of our country. Thank you. And now we are going to welcome Carla Patricia Cachaj Alvarez, a human rights activist with National Union of Guatemalan Women. She is going to share with us Angelica's communique after raids taking place at her home and her son's home.
El Estor Izabal, October 27th, 2021. Graham Russell, Rights Action and Friends. Please note and share. Today, October 27th at 6 a.m., a contingent of armed Guatemalan government security forces, including Civil National Police, Army, Anti-Narcotics Division, among others, entered the homes of Angelica Choc and her son, Professor Luis Adolfo H. Choc, to carry out raids at the same time. Inside our houses, there were minors and the pregnant wife of Professor Luis H. They entered when we were all still sleeping. We were frightened. We had a nervous breakdown when we received such a large number of armed security personnel. Without saying a word, they executed the search warrant without justifying the reasons for the search. It is unfortunate that the Guatemalan government is repressing the population and criminalizing indigenous leaders who watch over the rights of the Maya Quechí people. How outrageous the actions of the government defending Swiss Russian interests, defending the mining company Solway Investment Group from Switzerland and its CGN Pronico subsidiary. The company is still operating the Phoenix mine, despite the fact that in 2019, the Constitutional Court issued an order to suspend all mining operations. I, Angelica Choc, fear for the life of my family and the safety of my family. I hold the government of Guatemala and the company Solway Investment Group and CGN Pronico responsible for any risk or attempt against my life and my family. No more criminalization of human rights defenders and defenders of indigenous people. Enough repression. Angelica Choc.
Se ha agotado, se ha excluido al pueblo indígena, a nuestros ancestros, han sido excluidos por las autoridades de nuestro país. Muchas gracias.
To continue presenting more communities that are victims of the damage caused by Guatemalans and international elites, we welcome two more participants to our show tonight, Marta Julia Muñoz and Jackie McVicker. Marta is a Xinka woman from San Rafael Las Flores, where Escobal Canadian Mining Company operates. In brackets, Xinkas are indigenous people in Guatemala like Mayas. Jackie is a human rights activist based in Guatemala who has accompanied victims of Canadian mining companies for many years. Thank you, Marta and Jackie, for accepting our invitation. Here is our question. What are the effects of Canadian mining companies in your community, and what would you like Canadians to do about it? Thank you for the opportunity. The problems with this company are: no consultations in all the communities in the area, only in a few of them. No respect to the consultation results. 98% in our community said no to mining. Moreover, with the help of our corrupted government, we have suffered many violations of human rights. They criminalize every organized group in our region. A state of siege was declared in our communities in 2003, similar to the state of siege they just declared on El Estor Izabal. This way, they are violating our human and territorial rights that we have as indigenous communities. These violations have caused fear and divisions in our community. Many media outlets paid by our corrupted government transmit distorted information about our struggles. These companies produce a lot of waste and contamination. Water wells have dried up and poverty has increased. What would I like you to do? I ask you to please make your listeners in Canada aware of all the human rights violations that we have suffered. My message is not directed just to Canada. It is directed to any country interested in investing in transnational companies that destroy our natural resources, our harvest, our families, our societies.
It's really important for us to think about Canada's role in extractivism around the world, and how Canadian foreign policy around economic investment in different countries is really modeled on a framework of extractivism, on mining. This week, as COP26 is taking place in Glasgow, fossil fuel divestment seems like a no-brainer at this point, and investing in fossil fuels definitely is not a path towards any kind of sustainable future. And often, I think mining gets overlooked in terms of the role of mining in perpetuating environmental harm, as well as severe human rights violations around the world and in Canada. Canada is a world leader when it comes to mining, in big part because of the role our governments play in pushing this extractive agenda forward. It's often tied to other types of development, type of aid. Canada has had a huge role even in rewriting mining laws in other countries to make it easier for Canadian and other foreign companies to come in with very little required, with very low standards in terms of human rights and in terms of standards for environmental protection, and even in terms of the types of royalties or what could be was seen as opportunities, economic opportunities on the ground. In Guatemala, there's story after story after story of how communities have become divided because of mining. There's also so many experiences of, you know, homes cracking and falling apart, wells drying up, water contamination of the few water sources that there are in a community, which obviously mining waste is a huge issue for communities left to deal with the consequences of that harm and that potential harm of, you know, tailings pond waste and other toxins in their watersheds. I think that most Canadians are not aware of how Canadian mining companies are operating, that the role of the Canadian government has been to open the doors for this type of investment. And really, the Canadian government has... sorry, there's a little dog fight here. The Canadian government has time and time again refused to enact any kind of legislation in Canada to ensure that Canadian companies abroad would be held responsible for any type of harm, whether that be environmental harm or human rights violations, like the cases that we've seen in Guatemala are like murders, directly tied to mine security. In other cases, people being shot who have voiced their opposition. In other cases where there's been gang rapes and other very, very serious human rights violations being committed, there's no way to bring those companies into account, make them responsible, bring any court kind of justice. For now, it's a very slow process. If there's a few cases that have made it to Canadian courts, these are civil suits. So no one's being held criminally responsible yet in Canada for crimes they're committing overseas. And in places like Guatemala, where there are corruption is rampant, and the mining companies know that, and so they kind of operate under that understanding that you can kind of do whatever you want if you know who to buy off, who to influence. And so I think companies, Canadian companies, the Canadian government are accomplices in this corruption. They're accomplices in order to push forward this model that is widely rejected. In Guatemala, a few years ago, there was a survey, and you know, over 60% of all Guatemalans were against mining because they saw no benefit that it would bring, and they were worried about the negative consequences. Right now in Guatemala, there's a huge conflict taking place. It's around a nickel mine, which has been ordered to stop by the highest court in Guatemala due to lack of consultation with the affected indigenous communities around that mine. The company has refused. There's now a state of siege. People are being arbitrarily arrested. People have had their homes broken into that are part of the resistance movement. And so although that mine right now is owned by a Swiss company, this is the legacy of Canadian mining. This is a landmark mine, a nickel mine that was once owned by Inco and later by Sky and Sky Resources and Hudbay Minerals. And then was sold to the Swiss company. But this is kind of this legacy of, you know, a Canadian company coming in to an area, the affected community saying, we don't want you here. The Canadian company working in collusion with the Ministry of the Environment in order to push forward the project at any cost. You know, and, you know, 15 years later, we're seeing the consequences still of what a mine being implemented without the consent of the communities look like? So there have been decades of resistance and the communities are still not being listened to, and violence and destruction and death are still the norm for those communities. And most, you know, when you talk to folks, they're just like, we just want to live in peace, you know, we just want the mine to go away. We want it, you know, people don't want to spend their days having to fight a Canadian mine or any mine. And so when they have to put all their energy into just survival, it's tiring, it's exhausting. And so I think what we need in Canada are laws that ensure that companies that are responsible for harm can be prosecuted. We need laws so that there can be some kind of consequence for Canadian companies that are operating abroad in a way that is not coherent with, you know, our responsibilities as a people, as a country. And I think the Canadian government has perpetuated a lot of violence through Canadian mining. So I think the work, for example, of the Canadian Network on Corporate Accountability has been really important to lobby for laws. There's, you know, a few private member bills that people can support, and there's campaigns. But I think the other thing is that a lot of Canadians are invested in mining companies, whether it's through the Canadian Pension Plan or through private investments. Most people are still investing in mining, even when they're trying to invest ethically. They're often investing in companies that have very low, if any, standards for really how they're implementing their policies around human rights and environment. So, you know, encouraging folks to have a look at their investments, have a look at what banks they're putting their money into, getting behind laws that would make corporate accountability for Canadian companies mandatory. Those are all things, of course, that people can do. You know, I was thinking last week, you know, people in Guatemala are literally putting their life on the line to stop mining so that their kids and their grandkids can have water. And it's sometimes, you know, a Canadian doesn't want to just go onto their online banking and move an investment, which is like a click, you know, a click on your mouse, you know. So I think the very least people can do is look at where their money is going and how they're supporting companies that are perpetuating harm. It's not that hard to do. You can do it if people are willing to put themselves on the front lines to defend their communities and their water, but also the earth for all of us. You know, people aren't doing it just because of them. They're doing it because they feel a responsibility to take care of the earth. And I think a very small way that we can be part of that is, but important way, is for us to divest from these companies. So,
hoy me reconozco ante ustedes, sobreviviente de múltiples experiencias de muerte, sobreviviente de un nacimiento difícil, de una violencia permanente y eterna, de amores inacabados, de dolores sin sentido, de despedidas permanentes y de tristezas profundas. Hoy me reconozco ante ustedes sobreviviente de mí misma, de mi negación, de mi necedad, de mis máscaras, de mi falta de escucha. Me reconozco sobreviviente ante ustedes, de todos los sistemas opresores, de porque soy mujer, de porque soy lesbiana, de porque no tengo recursos, de porque pienso diferente, de porque soy de color, de porque no hablo bien, de porque no lo sé, de porque todo lo que ustedes quieran y crean. Me reconozco sobreviviente del reencuentro doloroso con todos mis recuerdos, olvidados, guardados, negados. Me reconozco sobreviviente de todo lo dicho y como tal me reconozco ante ustedes sobrevivientes de igual manera.
One more example of a victim of the powerful Guatemalas and international elites is my family. I can relate very well to the victims of mining companies. In a way, we fight for the same reason. We want to live in peace and offer our children a better world. When Carlos Leonel Cachac and I were studying at the University of San Carlos during the 70s, we met, fell in love, and formed a family of two daughters and a son. Manuel Galich described well the context in which we lived then, 10 years of democratic spring from 1944 to 1954 with revolutionary elected governments as an exception to the norm in Guatemala, a country of eternal tyranny with military dictatorships and economic elites supported by the United States. But for the 10 years of democracy and the initiation of a long needed changes and reforms, this was a long period of violence, the repression of total power without controls. Carlos and I understood then, and I understand now, that our problems in Guatemala started before the US-backed military coup in 1954. That ousted our only truly democratic governments. They began with the onset of European imperialism around the world, including the Spanish conquest of much of what is now known as Latin America. During this entire time, the majority population in this country, now called Guatemala, have lived under European imperialism, colonialism, and the interests of a small powerful elite under international partners. Carlos and I thought about the future of our family and the future of all people, and we dreamed about a world free of injustice and exclusion, in which everyone could have access to housing, nutritious meals, health, education, jobs, recreation, dignity, and respect. We both participated in groups and organizations of Guatemalan women and men with similar dreams. Carlos' activism participation focused on the students and teachers union movements and mutual support group, GAM, that was founded in the early 1980s by family members of the ever-increasing number of people, ordinary citizens who were being kidnapped and disappeared by government forces. We were also searching for the remains of Carlos's brother. His brother, Marco Antonio, had been supporting and working with peasants, small farmers in Chimaltenango and Zacatepeques. On December 29, 1982, he was forcibly disappeared by the illegal repressive structures of the corrupted Guatemalan state. As a family, we continue with our fight and demands for the whereabouts of Marco Antonio and so many other forcibly disappeared people. Carlos continued with his political activism at all fronts. On July 29, 1985, the same illegal structures and forces that disappeared and eliminated Marco Antonio and anyone questioning the Guatemalan state tried to kidnap Carlos. When he tried to escape, they assassinated him. Along with two other brothers of Carlos and Marco Antonio and their families, I came with my three children to Canada as political refugees in 1985. Some of us continue with Marco Antonio's and Carlos's struggle and have participated with different groups that support popular struggles ever since then related to Guatemala, Canada, and elsewhere. Thank you very much. We would like to thank Catherine Nolin, a professor at the University of British Columbia and human rights advocate. Angelica Choc, a defender of Quechí territory in El Estor Izabal. Carla Patricia Cachac Alvarez, a human rights activist with the National Union of Guatemalan Women. Marta Julia Muñoz, a defender of Xinka territory in San Rafael Las Flores. And Jackie McVicker, a Canadian human rights activist based in Guatemala. for giving us their time, sharing their experience and knowledge with us, so we hear and learn from the voices of victims and advocates about how the local elites in Latin America and international elites in the United States, Canada, and other countries operate in benefit of their own interests without consideration to the destruction of our planet and the suffering caused to communities affected by their actions, and what we should do to support the victims and our planet. We also thank Sandra Moran for her poem, In My Own Voice, about demanding and exercising the right to be a leftist feminist, opposing, resisting, organizing, and building a new world. And Sara Kuruchich and Rebecca Lane for her song, Kishampe, about history, memory, and resistance to land disposition and effects of war. And finally, we thank you, our audience, for listening to our show. Good night.
If you have flu-like or COVID-19-like symptoms, such as fever, cough, loss of taste or smell, or if you have been in contact with someone infected with the virus, it's essential to get tested and to follow isolation instructions, even if you're vaccinated. Screening remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. To find out more, visit quebec.ca/testcovid19. A message.